This is an RNZ podcast.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai ki te ao tai whanaua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Hello. Today, a warning: we should be tagging sheep as well as cattle in case foot and mouth gets in.
Needles are clacking in North Otago to keep Ukrainians warm come winter, and lambs are bleating at a sheep milking enterprise near Rotorua.
We also step back in time to Country Life's first year, 1997.
But first to our look at conditions around the country.
Starting in Southland, the sun hasn't shown its face for a few weeks and the grass is slow to grow. Bernadette Hunt is farming near Gore and says sheep farmers are scanning their ewes prior to lambing.
Real mixed bag coming through in the scanning percentages. Some are around normal, but some are quite significantly under normal, and that will be because of the drought that we had and lack of feed. Some challenges ahead for some of the sheep farmers around.
Bernadette Hunt says calving is going well, but winter is only halfway through and farmers are wondering whether they need to buy in more feed. In central Otago, vineyards are continuing to have difficulties finding enough staff to prune vines and help with trellis maintenance. And it's double trouble, as wet weather means pruning can't happen in the rain, water splashing from one vine to the other could spread fungal infections. Many of the region's Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc vines are usually trimmed for spring by now, but for many that's not the case. Grape growers hope freeing up the border will mean more workers from the Pacific region and further afield.
On the west coast, south of Hukitika, it's been a great year for pasture growth. There have been plenty of heavy downpours followed by long periods of good weather, so grass is flourishing. Dairy farmers don't start calving for another 2 weeks to a month, and the cows are in great condition. Cattle are being moved around to reduce pugging as much as possible, and there's a good supply of local silage. South of Christchurch, near Lincoln, Lake Ellesmere is continuing to overflow into surrounding farmland. About 25% of lower-lying farms are underwater, and cattle are being moved around to avoid muddy paddocks. Lambing's about to start in the challenging conditions. As one farmer says, it's not a surprise, but just a pain in the bum. Further inland, there's been flooding too. Frosts have been few and far between because of all the rain, so grass growth's been quite good for the time of year.
In the Nelson region, there is still surface water in some paddocks, and orchardists are frustrated about not being able to prune, as well as not having enough staff to do it. There's been at least 2.5 times more rain than usual over the last month. Apple and kiwifruit growers are also on the lookout for more casual workers. Heading north to Te Ika a Maui, plenty of lifestyle blocks in Wairarapa are lambing. Most of the real farms start a week or two later. Calving is in full swing and going well. Many farmers are checking herds at least a couple of times a day so newborn calves can get to dry sheds away from the boggy conditions. A few farmers are disgruntled about waiting times at the freezing works, which continue to fluctuate. Parts of southern Wairarapa had pretty severe flooding and are now cleaning up.
In Hawke's Bay, there's been a bit of sun over the week and early stone fruit trees are flowering in Bayview. Other stone and pipfruit trees are enjoying the chilly winter before budding closer to spring. Here too, a lot of growers are behind in their pruning due to a labour shortage and wet weather. Lambing has started and a close eye is being kept on rain and wind forecasts. In Taranaki, the rain's causing a bit of chaos in the middle of calving, but it's nothing the farmers can't handle and everyone's pretty well prepared. Moving stock among paddocks and onto dry pads is a bit like a tango on a dance floor. Farmers are trying to keep pasture and soil damage to a minimum. The rate of mastitis is described as not bad at all, and calf weights are pretty good too.
Taihape is continuing to have warmer soil temperatures than usual for this time of year, but wet weather and a lack of sunshine means the grass is growing at a minimal rate. Spraying via helicopter to kill pirina caterpillars has been happening on some farms. This pest munches through the grass and in large numbers can destroy whole pastures. Ewes are being scanned and our contact says he's got quite a few triplets and twins due when lambing starts in September. Cattle are currently being moved to swede and other fodder crops for a few months. Around Tomarunui, it's been time to get firewood stacked in the shed between showers. Scanning's done and lambing starts about mid-August, so the ewes are being moved to their set paddocks. Boggy pastures have farmers busy moving yearling cattle on a regular basis, and a few of the smaller beasts are likely to be sold in late August.
In the Bay of Plenty, some locals are noting it's been the wettest season for decades and grass is dying under saturated paddocks. Rick Powdrell farms near Te Puke and says there's been 870 millimetres of rain over the last couple of months.
The farms down on the flats, they are just basically underwater. They're just saturated. Quite awkward, but, you know, we soldier on. We have had a couple of dry years, so I suppose they do say these things average out. For us here, I can't feed some of my cattle because I just can't get to them with the tractor and silage wagon. Never had that before.
And Rick says he's lost a few early lambs born during torrential rain. The Waikato region is flat out with calving and lambing. Near Putaruru, last year's ram lambs are being sent to the works and margins are pretty good. But farmers are conscious they need to factor in more expensive fuel, fertiliser and labour costs.
South of Auckland, some main crop onion seed has not been sown and now it's too late. Growers are considering other varieties, but that may carry greater risk. Harvesting of lettuce and brassicas is erratic. Too much one week, not enough the next. Northland farmers are lambing and keeping a close eye on what's described as phenomenal rain on top of already wet soil. Like many other parts of the country, grass is struggling to survive under soaked paddocks, and some pasture is likely to need reseeding in early spring. Dairying is going well around Whangarei, with little lameness despite the bog, and farmers' morale is positive thanks to the decent dairy prices. The far north is over halfway through its calving with good body weights as pastures continue to grow. As a farmer near Kaitaia puts it, we need to expect winter to be too wet and summer to be too dry so we can deal with whatever is thrown at us.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
To the concern about foot and mouth disease now. With an outbreak in the tourist hotspot of Bali, many farmers are telling us they're worried about the potentially devastating virus hopping the border and infecting their livestock, despite tightened border surveillance and awareness campaigns. So just what is the risk? Our guest this week is Aaron Dodd, who's the Chief Investigator and Deputy Director of the Centre for Excellence for Biosecurity Risk Analysis, based at the University of Melbourne.
New Zealand's in really good position at the moment for reasons that might not be immediately obvious. New Zealanders would be well familiar with the Mycoplasma bovis outbreak over the last few years. And the thing that will have done for New Zealand that certainly doesn't apply in Australia is that you've had the opportunity to test your systems. So that the experience of New Zealand will mean that New Zealand will be better prepared as a result of the lessons that have been hopefully learned out of Mycoplasma bovis, but also the lessons that have been learned from, you know, the UK in 2001 have really reshaped the way in which biosecurity agencies around the world think about preparing for foot and mouth disease.
People may remember those alarming images of mass culls of livestock in the UK in 2001, but there was also an outbreak, a much smaller one, in 2007. So what were the lessons learned?
The UK outbreak in 2001 was so problematic because the theory was that it was originally detected in pigs. Pigs produce an enormous amount of virus that's capable of blowing on the wind. It moved onto the neighbouring farm where they had sheep. Sheep don't show as strong a clinical signs, and those sheep went to market, they were sold and then dispersed from one end of the UK to the other. You know, we're talking about 2,000 or more cases in the UK in 2001 compared to 8 cases in 2007, simply because the disease was reported more quickly and it was traced more effectively. Prior to where I am now, I was a senior advisor to Chief Veterinary Officer of Victoria, and he had been heavily involved in the UK outbreak in 2001, and one of his signature policy moves in his time as the Chief Veterinary Officer in Victoria, he was determined to get electronic identification of sheep and goats across the line. He was successful in convincing government to do that. That system was put in place in 2016, some 5 years ago now, and it's taken until this week that now the collection of Australian governments, states, territories and the Commonwealth have agreed to implement a national electronic identification process for sheep and goats in Australia. My understanding is that the equivalent of Australia's electronic system, NAIP, still doesn't include sheep, but there's the intention to move in that direction.
Yes, we tag our cattle and deer, but not our sheep. Are you saying in the fight against foot and mouth that that's going to be imperative?
Based on the advice that I've got from people that were involved in the UK experience, their view is that electronic traceability for all susceptible livestock for these kinds of infectious diseases makes a significant difference. The reason why during a foot and mouth disease outbreak, the policy that both the Australian and New Zealand governments have is 72-hour livestock standstill. That's in place because the virus is so infectious and we need to be able to trace our animals in that time. The experience in Australia is that because we have electronic identification for cattle, that that is able to be done within that 72-hour period. They've done a series of exercises. They were called the sheep catcher exercises in Australia, and they were unable to meet those 72-hour targets for sheep using the visual mob-based identification systems that we used here. So that, to me, would point to say, well, our policies are based around having 72-hour standstill to be able to do the contact tracing and get ahead of the virus. Because the virus is so infectious, if we don't have the systems that enable us to do that, then potentially that is a significant weakness.
Like Australia, we have many lifestyle block owners, and they may have a couple of sheep, a couple of goats, maybe a pig. What is the risk of foot and mouth coming through via a lifestyle block?
One of the big challenges of biosecurity is getting the message out to everybody that plays a role in keeping us free from pests and diseases. And certainly there's a perception that lifestyle block owners, and indeed even members of the urban population that are less connected to agricultural networks, are potentially more likely to engage in practices that are riskier from an introduction of pest or disease perspective. One of those is the feeding of meat products or meat byproducts to pigs. And that's illegal in Australia, and I'm not sure whether it is in New Zealand, but the reason why we're concerned about that is the sausage that comes through in somebody's backpack that might then get fed to a backyard pig has a really high chance of resulting in the infection of that animal.
New Zealand has a large population of feral goats and feral pigs, feral deer. What is the risk of foot and mouth spreading through them?
The research on this is pretty light. There is a strong suspicion and concern that the feral populations will make it more difficult to contain a virus outbreak if it does occur, because those animals obviously don't respect fence boundaries and have the ability to spread the disease sort of undetected and then act as a host or a reservoir where those populations could potentially bring it back onto a farm at a later stage and sort of elude official control. The extent to which that's a risk is still very difficult to put into numerical terms, because we haven't had that experience elsewhere overseas. So it's the only open question that we have at the moment about how an outbreak might play out either in Australia or New Zealand. Even Australia had foot and mouth disease outbreaks in the 1850s. 150 years ago, but New Zealand has always remained free. And the message that I've been putting out here is that foot and mouth disease has been endemic in large parts of the world, since it was first discovered in Italy in the 1500s. And the measures that we've deployed to date have been successful at keeping foot and mouth disease out. And we can only assume with the enhanced measures that are being put in place now, whilst the Indonesians bring this outbreak under control, that those enhanced measures will be enough to deal with the increased risk. And certainly with that new outbreak now showing early signs of coming under control, I think we can be confident that that New Zealand is in a really good place to both prevent and be prepared for an outbreak, which hopefully doesn't occur.
Aaron Dodd of the Centre for Excellence for Biosecurity Risk Analysis, speaking from Victoria. And yes, it is illegal in New Zealand too to feed pigs untreated meat. Biosecurity NZ has told us a review is underway to improve our sheep traceability, focusing on existing tools like animal status declarations.
Operation Cover-Up sends hand-knitted woolies to people in need in Eastern Europe. Knitting groups all over New Zealand have taken up their needles for the long-running project, started by Liz Clark in Taupō. 83-year-old Gladys Familton champions the cause in Oamaru.
I found out about it through the Christian magazine called The Challenge, which used to come out weekly, I think, in those days. Mm. And there was a little ad in the Challenge Weekly one week, and I saw it and I thought, oh, I love knitting. I've always been a knitter. And my grandmother and auntie and mother were all knitters. And so I thought, oh, I'll do that. And so that's when I started, and that was 22 years ago.
And you've been knitting for Operation Cover-Up ever since?
Ever since, yeah. And I've got some very keen knitting friends. They're all keen on this project. And we thought it would have fizzled out long ago because, well, it just seemed as though the need still wouldn't be there in this modern day. But the need is very much there.
What gets sent over?
Woolen blankets, woolen jerseys, hats and gloves and scarves. That's the knitting area for all ages. And also the Orwell Street Church, every year they've had a pyjama drive and they've sent banana boxes full of pyjamas, new pyjamas, to the children in these needy families. Yes, in time for the winter.
Mm. This year, all the things you've knitted will go to Ukraine, to people in need in Ukraine.
We're hoping, yes. Yes.
And you had, what, two wool bales full of lovely soft knitting?
Yeah, we did. We had 92 blankets, which was pretty good. We've always had up in the hundreds, but this year we didn't have quite so many. We haven't got quite so many knitters, but this year we had 92, which was really good because that made one whole bale, 60 blankets in a bale and half a bale. And then we filled the bale up with the jerseys and hats and that sort of thing.
You have been the project coordinator for a number of years. What does that involve?
Oh, well, it just means keeping in touch with people a little bit and trying to get wool for them if they need it. And then, of course, the big thing is getting the stuff away when you've got to get it collected in, you've got to get it counted and sorted and packed and taken out to the farm to get it baled.
So the bales can get sealed and pressed.
Yeah, pressed down, yeah.
Where do you source the wool from to do all the knitting?
Well, it's amazing where the wool comes from because there always seems to be some people that have got grandma's house to clean out and they find a whole lot of wool in the cupboard or something like this, you know, and they say, what can we do with this wool? Well, Operation Cover-Up might be glad of it, yes. So, and we find sources from all sorts of places. And we used to go to Alliance Textiles and get wool there, but it was good, hard-wearing, heavy wool. But we haven't had any from there for a while.
So you rely on donations?
Yeah, we do. Yes, the wool is expensive if you have to go to a wool shop and buy it. Yeah.
As we've mentioned, the shipment that you've just sent away is going to Ukraine. What are your views on the situation over there, on the war?
Oh, I think it's shocking. It's shocking. The way they're trashing civilian homes and schools and hospitals, and just shocking. When you think that Russia's got the biggest country in the world and they still want somebody else's country, or they still want to be lording it over others. No, I think it's wrong.
I guess it's going to be a challenge getting your wool bales into Ukraine?
It was a challenge last year, but it did get there. They go by container ship over to Holland, over to the Netherlands, and from there, the organisation called Mission Without Borders transports them over to Eastern Europe, and they just find the neediest country, you know, because they've been to Moldova, Romania, Ukraine. They're the three main ones.
Mm. You've got a blanket with you now that you're working on. How long does it take to knit a blanket?
Well, I reckon it takes 100 to 120 hours to knit a woolen blanket.
How satisfying is it for you knowing that all this work you're putting into knitting these lovely clothes and blankets is going to such a good cause?
Yeah, well, it is satisfying to know, because I feel, I don't know, people might disagree with this, but I feel that New Zealand children are well looked after, well cared for. If, you know, they've got benefits they can get if they're hard up and that sort of thing. But these children don't have anything like that to fall back on.
And how special having a hand-knitted blanket from New Zealand.
From the other side of the world. We get letters, you know, there's letters from the children and the people.
Mm. Gladys, well done. And yes, I'm sure everything that you knit is really appreciated wherever it ends up.
Yes, well, it seems like it. So that's why we keep doing it. Yes, it's just one of those things that you don't want to give up if there's still a need.
Gladys Familton speaking to Cosmo Kentish Barnes.
Country Life, 25 years of stories from the land.
Now, when Country Life first hit the airwaves on January the 24th, 1997, who knew that 25 years later it would still be going strong? The new rural magazine show was hosted by Brian Crump and Di O'Connell, and then Sarah Willis. This piece from our archives rounds up that first year when rabbit calicivirus disease, RCD, arrived in New Zealand, illegally introduced by farmers desperate to control the pests feasting on their pasture. The show also delved into health topics that year, and you might wonder what's changed. The team also liked to take a light-hearted slant on things. In 1997, Wools of New Zealand, with great fanfare, declared socks made of wool smelt less than those in other fibres. So Country Life tested this out on the RNZ tennis team, including Sarah Willis. David Knowles picks up the story.
Sarah was joined by reporters Chris Roberts and Nick Hurst. Each of the trio put on a clean pair of socks. Sarah took the merino number, Nick the nylon cotton blend, while Chris wore pure cotton. The plan was to remove the socks after a good stint on the court and run them under the nose of our guest star snorter, Morning Report's Sean Plunkett.
So look, you can have
look
these.
Look at what I have to wear. Are those woolen, those?
No, these are cotton.
The... Am I the only one wearing wool?
If I end up with
these
a major
are cotton
injury.
Nylon. These are cotton nylon mix.
Have we got the other ball?
Nick?
So there's a hint of natural fibre in there, is there?
There's a very slight hint.
So, it's off to the lab, where the eager nostrils of Mr. Plunkett are ready.
Right, well, I'll open up the specimen case. I know you've got a hard nose, and
the blend is sort of bearable, and those are particularly strong. So I'd say the blend followed by the merino, followed by the cotton.
But this leaves Wools of New Zealand's claim in tatters. What went wrong? Well, to explain, we're joined by Wools of New Zealand's sock and woolly underwear spokesperson, Roger Buchanan.
How is it that you managed to slip behind nylon socks on the old smellnometer?
Brian, I think your research must be faulty. But really, to get a proper analysis of this, really you need to conduct it on monkeys, so as you can put four different socks on four different legs, you see, so as you can get a proper tell off the same animal.
Now, one of the big rural issues of 1997 was health services, or lack of them. Country Life first caught up with the story in January when we visited Otago. In Roxburgh, we found nurse Margaret Eckhoff working out of a cramped doctor's surgery.
So how many rooms have you got? Here, there's this surgery
We've got the treatment
here.
Room and the doctor's room.
and quite often I have to see people in the kitchen where we did the interview. Often have to do bloods, blood pressures, dressings. Well, we had that boy in the accident out there the other day.
And that was the kitchen?
Mm, that's how cramped we are. And that's also my desk where I do things. Yeah, mini hospital.
Very mini. Now, 1997 was also the year the nation looked at future options for its roading system.
Just here, the road is a single lane. That's because...
Across the country, rural councils are struggling to keep their roads going without increasing their rates. Last autumn, one road facing a tough future was the route linking Martinborough with Cape Palliser in South Wairarapa. The South Wairarapa District Council was pouring millions into the road, which just as quickly was falling into the sea. Mike Sinclair is about to show me the Papa Cliffs, one of the most erosion-prone parts of the road.
Now, how far is, in the time you've been here, how far has the coastline retreated?
Probably in the vicinity of about 40 feet of land.
Some good news came at the end of the year when South Wairarapa District councillors were told the government would give them extra funding for the road. And as the year draws to a close, the government appears to be favouring a more direct user pays approach for road funding in the future.
Growing disillusion among Southland's sheep and beef...
Now, down in Southland, the dairy conversion boom was turning sour. Dairy farmers who headed south in the hope of a good life were being hit by the cost of expanding the Southland Dairy Co-op's processing capacity. A new Country Life recruit, Sarah Willis, went to find out why people made the move.
North Island dairy farmers were invited to see what Southland had to offer. Couples like Margaret and Bill Moller, who liked what they saw, then sold their farm in Taranaki and shifted south. They were amazed at the Southland conditions.
Per cow for us has been quite a boost coming to Southland. I think probably with the better pasture growth, the longer days, the cows are better fed, you don't get quite a number of health problems associated here in South, and you know, if you look at them, most of these are heifers that you see, and you know, they just keep such good condition.
Now, 1997's been big on weather. Right now, most of the eastern side of New Zealand is either in or heading for drought. But in July, the problem in Northland was too much water. Floods cut off much of the top of the country, and Sarah, my, that woman was busy, got caught right in the middle of it.
Further along when we get into Kawakawa, I can imagine it'll be pretty swamped there.
But the biggest rural story of 1997 had to be this.
Today I've announced that the application to import the RCD virus as a biological control for rabbits should be refused. This means that it will continue to be illegal to import the virus. It would be contrary to our biosecurity policy to permit the introduction of an organism which can't confidently be predicted to produce benefits that are at least commensurate with the risks that are being taken.
The Ministry of Agriculture's Deputy Director General, Peter O'Hara, announcing rabbit calici virus, RCD, would not be introduced as a rabbit biocontrol. That July decision had farmers like Ben Aubrey from Omarama in the South Island High Country spitting tacks.
You would have to wonder whether the decision makers have a place in the society anymore, whether they actually have their heart in the job.
What do you think motivates them then? Why have they made this decision?
I would hate to think. I couldn't think of any reason why I can't answer that.
It just doesn't make sense to you?
It just doesn't make sense. I just can't believe it. I just, with all that there was to be gained, to make it a decision like that, the next logical decision will be that we're not allowed to travel overseas in case we come in contact with RCD.
Well, with hindsight, MAF probably wishes it had taken Mr. Aubrey's advice on that one, but more on that later. Meanwhile, farmers had something else to get upset about, the Resource Management Act. And nowhere was that outrage more keenly felt than in the far north, where the district council was copping serious flak from local farmers angry at how its district plan environmental protection measures were cutting across what they saw as their property rights.
Of all the district plan disputes, Northland's is the most bitter. This week it turned ugly at a rally in Kaikoui to support two farmers in court for moving dirt onto a farm track.
Far North District Mayor Sue James getting a rough ride from Northland farmers. Now, along with being the time for discontent, Winter's also when the central North Island town of Ohakuni harvests much of the carrot crop it's famous for. And to celebrate, it has a carnival. Which is where I found Bernie at his multi-coloured Ford Zephyr, the ultimate carrot picker's car.
If you're coming to work, you'd have to go pick him up at the TAB and then they say, oh, I'll just drop you off here at the pub here, bro, and I'll be right, you know. So, yeah. You know, you sort of got about, used to get about 3 days a week, you'd come about Friday, payday, you wouldn't see them until about Monday, you know, so.
Funnily enough, carrots of a different kind were in the news shortly afterwards. You see, 1080 carrots were being used by South Island high country farmers to spread a strain of RCD illegally brought into the country. As many had promised after MAF rejected the initial application to bring in RCD, the disease was here anyway. In fact, farmers had had it for close to 2 months before the news broke in late August. And the first person they told? Our Sarah.
But what about the legality of it? What about the fact that it was an illegal organism, so to speak?
Well, do you know, we didn't really actually think too much about that at that stage, because we had something that we knew was in 43 other countries of the world. We knew from all the submissions, from all the paperwork that had been gone through to find out whether we could have it in New Zealand, that it was not going to harm humans, it wasn't going to harm any animals, and they had come out, MAF had come out and said that it wasn't going to harm anyone. And so we had decided as farmers that it was safe enough. No one could come up with any concrete evidence to say that it was going to do any damage.
Problem is, the jury's still out on whether the disease is doing serious damage to rabbit populations. But the move sure damaged confidence in the integrity of New Zealand's biosecurity system. Now, it was about this time that a new development in rural transport arrived on the scene. Milk trains. The ever-expanding Kiwi Dairy Company contracted Transrail to bring over 1 million litres of milk a day from its Aringi depot in the Tararua district.
Bloody brilliant scheme, you know. They're talking about opening up more of them. This is an experimental one, see how it goes.
So these ones at the back there...
The trains take the milk to Kiwi's plant in Whareroa in South Taranaki. The whole thing has big implications for the dairy industry, dominated by news of mergers and plant centralisation. It may eventually make it possible for two or three companies to process all the country's milk on just a few sites.
Pretty hard to get in here.
Thanks very much. G'day, Bob. So this is a... You don't have seat belts on these things?
No.
Oh, we're moving.
Yep.
That was a smooth start.
And so at about 5.45, a few minutes early, train 544 begins to crawl around the horseshoe curve that links the milk silo with the main line. Behind us, 3,000 horsepower, 14 wagons, 800 tonnes, and 500,000 litres of milk.
We've always wanted to do this, folks.
In October, we return to Roxburgh to pick up on the health debate.
Well, very soon we hope the plans go out to tender to the building.
Crown Health Enterprises are pulling out of providing rural health services and leaving the job to local trusts. Thousands took to the streets in protest. But Margaret Eckhoft in Roxburgh is optimistic. They've got their old hospital back and are keen to get more local control.
But not a lot of structural changes. We've got to get rid of the asbestos, check out the wiring, check out the sprinklers, and just make the place into a medical centre that the district can be very proud of.
And so basically people are coming up and they are guessing as to how long it'll take for this thing to go sky high.
Well, stop.
Into November and the annual Whangamomona Republic Day. The tiny Taranaki town declares its independence every year in protest at a 1988 local government boundary change that took it out of the Taranaki region. These days, though, it's more of a fundraiser for the local community, and a chance to engage in the annual ritual sacrifice of the local bomb. The car's engine is drained of oil and water and someone puts a brick on the accelerator, with people placing bets on how long they think it'll last. It's amazing what people think up to pass the time in out-of-the-way places.
Stop the clock! Stop the clock! And the winning time, mid. 38.27.
This ends our broadcast from the Assembly Hall of Wellington.
Also
Girls
gone,
College,
correspondent school broadcasts on National Radio. Goodbye. Radio New Zealand's Elizabeth Alley explains why.
I think the younger people for whom that experience is designed are not listening, and I think that radio as a learning tool is something that is no longer viable for young people. We know that children under the age of five are learning the internet. There is not only television and CDs and FM music experience, but CD-ROM. There's a huge range of learning experiences now available to children through CD-ROM and video and so forth that is more attractive to them than radio.
But then down the comeback trail came Chesendale, the animated farmers who sold your Chesdale cheeses in the 1970s, which inspired us to sing our own version as a tribute to the kitchen whiz skills of those intrepid farmers who spread rabbit calici virus across the high country.
We are the boys from down the farm, we know our RCD. It's much quicker spreading with cheddar, it never fails to please. It appeals to rabbits' eating habits.
Once they taste it, then they've had it.
There's no waste, but still it's got a mighty taste. RCD, with kiwi cheddar, works better.
The 1997 rural year, as told and sung by the Country Life team of Brian Crump and Sarah Willis.
And we're joining Susan Murray now on a farm visit. The story starts near the end of May.
Hello.
Look totally different to New Zealand Romney and the other the sheep that we have over our hills and properties. These sheep really don't know that they're sheep. Oh, they're walking away. They're very quiet. Oh, here they come, yes. They're like our dairy cows. They're quiet. Soon as generally, and especially in the milking season, as soon as they see us walking to the gate, they'll bring themselves, expecting us to open the gate because we're going to go somewhere. And, they take themselves from the yard up the ramp onto the platform. And, yeah,
it is. They go up to the platform because they get, you know, different sorts of feed.
In shed feeding.
Yeah. So they love that. That's like their dessert. They're out here having the main course, this beautiful grass that we grow, and then go in the shed and have all the goodies.
And those are mainly East Frisian sheep that we're meeting there. We're also with Onuku Māori Lands Trust trustee Tina Nātai, Trust Chair Barnett Virko, and Trust General Manager Angela Farikura. And we're looking at some of the 1,800 sheep the Trust is running on one of its farms half an hour south of Rotorua, near Rerewhakaitu. They've had two seasons milking sheep here. The first sod was turned in December 2019 to convert one of their four bovine farms to an ovine one. And the timing couldn't have been worse. COVID arrived, but so too were 1,400 pregnant ewes by mid-August 2020. Regardless of the challenges, that deadline had to be met. And it was. A 72-bale rotary and covered lambing sheds were done. The Onuku Trust hopes it's paving the way for other Māori trusts in the central North Island to look at sheep milking as a business. Tina says it's hopefully a sound financial diversification, but that's not the main reason for developing the sheep milking platform.
We've been very conscious of what's happening in the environment with our farming, and with, at that time, four cow dairy farms, we were getting increasingly concerned about our footprint, you know, the nitrates, water use, all of those things, and the dairy sheep, indications were it was going to be much better. And so now, second season, we're definitely seeing the benefits of that. I mean, water use has been 35% reduction, that's amazing. Yeah. Nitrates is considerably less. Yeah. We're not seeing so much shift in phosphate, however, you know, they're still trying to do the formula to gauge that. And the same with greenhouse gases. We're currently monitoring that to see whether we've got any gain. So environmentally, this is a better use for our land and for the environment generally.
Mm. And the other thing is that it does actually increase the number of staff. So we're offering more employment. So whereas this farm originally had two people employed full-time, we've now got four full-time, plus all the casuals that come through, which can be up to, 12 people, during lamb rearing, and another few casuals that come in. So we're offering a lot more employment, both, housed on farm and also drive-in staff that we're giving to people in the area. So,
as a group of trustees, that's what we wanted to achieve. You know, there's more to life than money. And we've got communities like Kaingaroa and Minganui and Murupara that have really benefited from getting some casual work with us.
Mm. We plan in 25, 50, 100-year plans, Māori do, and so this is about us further diversifying.
It's an exciting industry for people who want to get into to something that's innovative and that has a huge future. We've had people who've come from the dairy industry across and found it so interesting, just the different system, the sheep, etc.
This is a huge investment, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, this is $3.5 million to set this up.
Wow.
We went for a hybrid model because we were concerned about the welfare of the animals. So for us, it was also about, we didn't want, you know, this is pretty cold climate and pretty hot in summer. So this way they get sheltered, the sheep can come in and out, and we just felt it was a better.
And hybrid meaning what? They get a bit of grass, but they're also indoors.
Yes.
Is it?
Yep. Yes. Yep. Yes. So we've got two big housing barns here, as you see, both 150 metres long each. And we can house our whole flock in there in adverse conditions. And in actual fact, just prior to lambing, they will move in. They're out on the paddocks now because look at the day. It's beautiful. And they lamb in there and then, well, the lambs are eventually taken off their mothers and the mums come through the milking shed. And the system starts over again.
And the other system, the other reason for the barns is in the heat of summer. We find that production certainly is a lot better if they're in the shade.
Because there's about a 3-4 degree drop in temperature, the summer temperature, being inside. And of course, these sheep, they are high production sheep. They're just like our dairy cows, you know, and they're bred to be milkers.
And how's it sort of gone? How's it been?
Oh, look, being Māori, we were very conservative with our plan, with our numbers. And as I say, we've just completed our second season, and both seasons we've exceeded our numbers. I'll just leave it at that.
We're a very happy trust.
Yeah.
And did it move? Well, right. Yeah. And did it take much convincing for the other trust beneficiaries that this was a good thing to do?
Well, so we're a what's called an Ahu Whenua Trust. So there's six of us appointed to work on the trust, the owner's behalf, and we've got a big ownership, some...
Or 4,700 owners.
So we don't go and ask them, but what we do is do really excellent due diligence, and the due diligence for this was took about 5 years. And we briefed the owners that we were considering this. But when it came to the decision to move, that was a decision for the trustees.
And how long is it going to take you to pay off all of this infrastructure?
Well, we're a big trust. Like I said, we've got three bovine dairy farms as well, as well as a big dry stock operation. So, we're a corporate farmer.
I suppose realistically, if it were just this, and based on the turnover now, we're probably looking at 12 years to repay that. But it's farming. Next week we could have a huge weather event and suddenly wipe us out for the next 6 months. So, you know, we're very cautious, yes.
Yeah. Should we walk down and have a bit of a look?
I'll leave one here too. We won't forget it.
Actually, and Tina, as we're walking down to have a look at these sheep, there's also the Māori Agribusiness Sheep Milk Collective. What's that?
So I'm the co-chair of that collective, and that's an initiative assisted by MPI, Ministry of Primary Industries, who gave us some funding to take about 20 quite large Māori trusts and incorporations and investigate whether this is a good land diversity for those trusts. And one of the drivers, of course, is the environmental footprint. So that's what set it off. But also, Ōnuku joined that collective because they're doing it. So we're able to actually prove what works and what doesn't, authenticate the numbers for conversion. So all of that has helped to make it a very strong collective. And just currently finishing, with the help of AgFirst, the investigation for every member on whether their land is suitable for conversion.
But wow, so that would be 20 different
Potentially.
And how's it? Yes, okay.
Yeah, so covering maybe, you know, we think maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, between the collective, we could be milking 15,000 ewes.
15,000
yeah.
ewes. What area are those collectives in? Like, they range from sort of here up to Hauraki?
Yeah, the first one is sort of down Hauraki way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, over to Taupō and across here to Murupara, because we've got Ngāti Whare involved. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So out of that has driven a whole lot of other parts we're investigating with ag research, like what are we going to do with rams, you know?
Yes.
So a sheep doesn't always give you a little girl. And so what do we do with those rams? Because euthanasia is not acceptable to us as Māori, so we want to find out an alternative. Wool, an awful lot of wool kind of be coming out of it. And the other thing is food, what grains, bedding. So we think there might be a whole lot of byproducts that could come out of dairy sheep. So that's part of the collective.
And you'll see here, so that the Miscanthus bedding that we have, which is the large bales at the end there, it's a type of grass, very, very tall, almost like an elephant grass, that is used for bedding. And as it breaks down, as we roll it out during the season, we clean the barns out, and that goes off to make lovely compost.
Of course.
So if a small trust with less money, they might want to just raise the lambs. You know, there's an industry there growing Miscanthus bedding. So we're grateful for the money that we've received from MPI, and we believe we're using it really wisely. And we've got Ag First and Trade and Enterprise New Zealand helping us as well.
And where are the markets at the moment?
Well, mostly, well, spring sheep are doing dried milk powder, aren't they? Are they doing infant formula?
Infant formula.
Mostly into Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Taiwan, those countries.
We'll go through this way and we can walk down to the flock down there.
Okay.
So here's our sheep.
And how does it feel to be part of this project?
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and it's really wonderful as a Māori Land Trust to be part of something that's quite new. You know, I mean, relatively speaking, it's a new industry. Mm. Yeah, and it's been so successful. We've surrounded ourselves with great people, and boy, has that paid dividends.
Yeah.
And you the same?
Oh, look, yeah. I've been on this trust 20 years, and I've seen this trust really progress from what was one big dry stock operation to diversifying into dry stock plus bovine dairy, and also along the way planted out a Pinus radiata forest, and now into this industry of sheep milking. So we've been a very progressive trust.
And what are we looking at here, Angela?
Oh, actually, you could see across there, Sparkle. Sparkle's a little black sheep.
She's out there?
She's out there, yes.
What of that you help bring into the world, Barnett.
One of the lambs that we reared in that first season, and she's out here now as a milking sheep.
And they're mixed age, these ewes?
Yep.
But you're finding that certainly as each year goes by, we're getting genetically better and better and better, so the production is increasing. And we're very surprised, well, we're pleasantly surprised by how that's going.
Yes.
It's quicker than expected.
It's now the fourth week of July on the Onuku Trust Farm, and activity has ramped up a peg or three. Farm manager Rudolf van Zijdem has swapped kids for lambs, and there are already 720 young ones in the barn. How are you finding lambing? Because, you know, you've come from a goat farm, haven't you? So kidding compared with lambing.
Yeah. It's much of a muchness, Sue. Things are going pretty good. Thank goodness we didn't come from a cow farm, because we've got a lot of little pens and a lot of animals in the barn at the moment.
And you'll end up with what? 2,800 here at the end?
2,800 near the end, yep. Yeah, probably just over, but yeah, we're budgeting on 2,800.
It's a lot of lambs, isn't it?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of lambs on the ground, I'll tell you what.
And how many staff have you got in here?
Got 6 backpackers that's helping us at the moment. One of the local ladies and then my wife.
What do you enjoy about this bit of the season?
it's just nice to see the lambs on the ground. Oh, they're magnificent animals, and when they run around in their groups, it's really awesome. And then all your hard work for the season all coming together. I think that's what the main one is for us, yeah.
And how long will they stay in this barn here?
In this barn here, they'll probably stay here for probably a good 4 to 6 weeks. And then we've got space that we can run them indoors and outdoors.
Do you watch them 24 hours a day?
No. We've got to give the people a break too. So we usually watch, we start 5 o'clock in the morning. So the first eyes go over them at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then we finish off at about 7:30 at night. So that's usually where the last job we do is just walk through them and make sure everything is happy and healthy.
Rudolf van Zijdam, talking to Susan Murray. The last lambs will be arriving towards November.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you next week. Ka kite.
Bye now.